For the past 30 years, Michael Morrell has been on the front lines battling terrorism and seeking out those who would do our country harm at the CIA. The Great War of Our Time is his new book and is not just a chronicle of his career and his unique experiences. It's also a look at the rise of an organized global terror network and an analysis of how this was allowed to happen, as well as a behind-the-scenes look at the actions that has our country has taken to protect itself. Again, the name of the book is The Great War of Our Time. Michael Morrell is the former CIA deputy director, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. I appreciate it.
Joe, it is terrific to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Very nice to have you with us. When you start off on a project like this, and there's a mission statement, I guess, a bit of a mission statement of what you want to accomplish, what was that you wanted to accomplish in telling a story like this?
Yeah, great question, Joe. So really three things. One is I'm deeply concerned about this particular kind of extremism that we have faced since the late 1990s, since 9/11. I'm deeply concerned that it's going to last for a very long time, that my children's generation and my grandchildren's generation are still going to be fighting this fight. So I really wanted to tell the public about that threat and how to think about it and to give them an understanding of it. The second thing I really wanted to do was bring people inside the CIA. There's a lot of myths out there about the agency. You know, one is a kind of a James Bond myth that we can do anything, that we can steal any secrets, stop any plot. And that's not true. You know, there's another myth out there that we're kind of Maxwell Smart, right? And everything we touch, we fail at, and that's not true. And then there's this kind of Jason Bourne myth, which is that we're a rogue agency, that we're operating without the approval of the White House and Congress, and that's a myth. And I really wanted to get across the reality of what it's like to work there, which is amazingly dedicated people, committed, working hard, trying to protect the country, to get many, many things right, but also, like any organization, get some things wrong. And so that's what I really set out to try to do, those two things.
It is obviously a fascinating story. You were by President Bush's side on 9/11 when terrorists struck this country, and you're in the White House Situation Room advising President Obama when Osama bin Laden was killed. That's almost a bookend, isn't it? Bookends.
Yeah, exactly. And for me, maybe the most special moment related to both of those bookends was 2 weeks after we captured bin Laden, and I tell the story in the book, President Obama, knowing that I was with President Bush on 9/11, President Obama asked me to fly to Dallas and brief President Bush on the operation. I took with me the lead analyst, and I took with me the lead military operator. We spent 2 hours with President Bush. We walked him through the whole story. He asked many, many questions. He was like a kid in a candy store. And at the end of those 2 hours, he gave me one of his commander-in-chief challenge coins, and we shook hands. And, you know, I felt some closure from 9/11 at that moment. And it was a very, very special thing for President Obama to do for both me and President Bush, and really kind of the special moment of the bookends.
Because I would think that it's hard to become removed from it. Obviously, elections happen, and then you're no longer in office. But what has started, and what was your day-to-day function of working as President of the United States and being Commander-in-Chief, that doesn't just go away when you leave office.
Right, exactly. And in fact, this is going to surprise many people, but the first phone call that President Obama made after we brought bin Laden to justice was a call to President Bush to tell him. So there was this, you know, there's this this very small group of presidents, right, who really understand how difficult the job is and what it's like, and they do share, right? They do share a lot together.
So let us go beyond the bookends for a moment and talk to us about what you lay out in the book, and that is this fight against terrorism by the CIA from Al-Qaeda and now to ISIS, which we see again, and we look at its really incredibly rapid rise in just the past year.
Right. And you know, it really goes back. ISIS really goes back quite a long way. You know, it started out as Al-Qaeda in Iraq. It had significant ups and downs. When we departed Iraq at the end of 2001, when U.S. military left Iraq, Al-Qaeda in Iraq was added to Nader. And very quickly after we left, Joe, it started to rebound. And it started to rebound for two reasons. One was that the military pressure came off. The Iraqis were simply not as good as they were with our assistance. And then the other reason they rebounded was former Prime Minister Maliki took a number of steps that disenfranchised the Sunnis in Iraq, and that led moderate Sunnis to kind of join AQI. And so they had this rebound even before Syria. And then they go across the border into Syria, change their name, get their hands on recruits, get their hands on Assad's weapons, and get their hands on money, and they become this very powerful organization that comes back to Iraq and sweeps through Iraq in the blitzkrieg. And so actually it's quite a long story of how that happened, and it's going to take quite some time to roll them back.
When you say quite some time to roll it back, it gives a sense that we sort of know where we're going, and I think most people looking at the situation, and certainly nothing new now, it seems like we've been in this pattern for almost a decade and a half of not being exactly sure where we are and what the next step should be.
Yeah, I'm pretty confident about the strategy in Iraq, which is to train Iraqi forces, actually retrain them, right? They were training once before. Retrain Iraqi forces. And when we do that, along with U.S. air power, I think we'll be able to roll them back. We just had this significant setback in Ramadi, but the big picture is brighter. The big picture is that we've taken back about 25% of the territory that ISIS took in that blitzkrieg that I talked about. So I'm pretty confident on the Iraq side of the border. Joe, I'm less confident in Syria because I don't see a ground force in Syria to go with the air power. And so I don't see a strategy in Syria, and I'm concerned about that because these guys are actually on both sides of that border.
What is the rationale behind that, and what is, and again, is it just a general unsettlement in the area of not knowing what the right thing to do is?
You know, I think the answer is, and you know, sometimes I read op-eds, right, and in which in 8, 10, 12 paragraphs, people solve all these very tough national security problems, right? And I read them and I kind of smile because I know how hard these national security issues are. I've been in, you know, lengthy meetings in the Situation Room where these are really tough issues. And I think Syria is one of the toughest national security problems I've ever seen because it really encompasses two of the biggest dynamics in the Middle East. One is the threat that's posed by Islamic extremism, right? And that's the al-Nusra and that's the ISIS problem in Syria. The other dynamic, the huge dynamic at play there, is this struggle between Iran and the Sunni Gulf states. There's actually a proxy war going on in Syria between Iran and those Sunni states, and that gets in the way of this whole dealing with the ISIS problem. You know, the just dealing with the ISIS problem, we would back President Assad. But if you just look at the Iran-Sunni dynamic, we would go all in against Assad. So it's very, very, very complicated and very difficult to know exactly what to do and how to balance all of these competing forces.
You talk about in the book that despite the efforts of the CIA to keep Iraq and Al-Qaeda very separate issues, that there was, going back to 2001 and post 9/11, an effort to bring those two together.
So one of the very, very important questions that we were asked after 9/11 was, is there any indication of a link between Al-Qaeda and Iraq? And you know, we really looked at that question hard. And for a time, for a period of time, it looked like there was a connection. It looked like the lead hijacker, Mohammed Atta, had traveled to traveled to Europe to meet with an Iraqi intelligence officer. And we, you know, we ran that down, and it turned out not to be true. But you know, that question lingered, and we finally wrote a paper in which we said, look, we don't think that there's a current link. We don't think that Iraq had anything to do with 9/11, even knew about 9/11 in advance. And there were some people in the Bush administration, really in the vice president's office, who continued to push this theme, you know, who continued to publicly suggest there was a link. And that was you know, something that happened in that time period.
You do write in the book that despite the paper and its conclusions, there were senior administration officials, most significantly the vice president, who continued to imply publicly that there was a current connection between Iraq and al-Qaeda. This was inconsistent with the analysis, but the implications continued, all to the detriment of the American people's understanding of the truth. If we had that truth, and this question is being asked of presidential candidates now, if we had that truth, would we be in this mess that we're in?
Yeah, Joe, there's really two separate issues here. One is the analysis about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction program, and then separately, the analysis about Iraq's relationship with al-Qaeda. Two completely separate issues. And on the first, there's a view out there, right? You hear it all the time. There's a view out there that the administration, hardliners in the administration, particularly Vice President Cheney and his office, pushed the intelligence community into this view that he had weapons of mass destruction. That is a myth, and I take, you know, quite a bit of time in the book to show that. That is a myth, and all I have to tell you, Joe, is that we had that view prior to President Bush even coming to office. We were telling President Clinton that Saddam had these programs. So on that, there wasn't any political pressure. You know, we were there. On the Iraq and al-Qaeda issue, that's a different story, right? We were pushed to there, but we did our job, and we held our ground. Our analysts wouldn't budge from what they really believed. And when we got to Iraq and we looked at the files of the Iraqi intelligence service, you know, it turned out that we were right, that there wasn't a relationship between the two. So two very different issues. I think the more important one was the Iraqi weapons of mass destruction judgment in terms of driving the president's thinking about Iraq and how to deal with it.
But it did ultimately bring us to war.
The Iraq weapons of mass destruction
judgment,
absolutely, because I think what was in the president's mind was two things.
But also in the selling
was,
I'm sorry, but also in the selling, it brought us to war. But also in the selling to the American people, it was getting back at and trying to retaliate for what happened on September 11th.
So I don't see it that way, and I talk about this in the book, right? My view on the way President Bush thought about this, right? And he's the only person that can really tell you this, you know, in what was in his head. But my sense was that the context, right, the context in which he made this decision was 9/11 had just happened, right? 3,000 people had just been killed. The intelligence community is telling him that Saddam has weapons of mass destruction. Saddam is one of our enemies, right? The intelligence community is also telling him that Saddam provides support to international terrorist groups, not al-Qaeda, but Palestinian terrorist groups, right? And so the president is sitting there thinking, you know, what if Saddam uses these weapons of mass destruction against us, or what if he gives these weapons to one of those terrorist groups and they use them against us? So that's the context, right? And it wasn't only the president who thought that this was the right thing to do. It was a majority of members of Congress who were looking at the same context. So I think it's actually an unfair question to ask candidates, you know, looking back now, would you have done this, right? Nobody has 20/20 hindsight. And one of the things I really try to do in this book is not make a judgment about whether presidential decisions are right or wrong. What I try to do is provide the context in which the president made those decisions at the time. And I think providing that context helps people understand the decisions a little bit better.
Okay, so with that said, were there mistakes made in that decision-making process, in not just those specifics, but overall that got us to the situation that we're in now? Did we drop the ball?
I think the biggest mistake that was made, and I talk about this in the book, I think the biggest mistake that was made was the de-bathification decisions by the coalition provisional authority. So the folks that took over after the U.S. military won the initial battle, right? Defeated Saddam's army. They made two decisions. One decision was to remove anybody from the Iraqi government who was a member of the Ba'ath Party, and number two, to essentially disband any organization that had significant links to the Ba'ath Party. And that resulted in a crumbling of the Iraqi security services, of the Iraqi army. And all of those guys, right, who relied on a paycheck, didn't have a paycheck anymore. And so they took their services to the highest bidder in some cases, right, to Al-Qaeda or to the Iraqi insurgency. So I think it was those two decisions, those two de-bathification decisions that were the most significant mistake. That's what brought instability at the end of the day to Iraq.
When you look at the current state of affairs now as a former CIA deputy director, where does your optimism lie that progress can be made?
So I didn't say I was optimistic.
No.
You know, what the book basically says is, you know, there are two parts to this extremism problem. One part are the guys who already are terrorists, right? They've already been radicalized, and they want to attack us. They want to kill us, and they are trying to do so. And so one thing we have to do is deal with them. We've actually done a really good job since 9/11 dealing with those guys, right? The other thing we have to do, because at the end of the day, you can't capture and kill your way out of this. The other thing we have to do is we have to find, and it's not just we, it's our allies, it's actually more our allies. We have to find a way to deal with the underlying causes. The underlying causes of radicalization, the societal, the religious, the economic, the underlying causes which are radicalizing so many young men and women. And we can't do that on our own because we really need, we don't have a lot of credibility in a lot of those conversations. So we need Muslim leaders, we need Muslim clerics, we need Muslim teachers, we need Muslim parents to really engage on this issue. And so that's the long war. That's the only way that we're going to win this thing over the long term, because as many people as we take off the battlefield, which we have to do to protect ourselves, they're putting more people on because of these underlying causes that I'm talking about.
Michael Morrell is former CIA deputy director and author of the new book, The Great War of Our Time. It is published by 12. Michael Morrell, a pleasure and privilege to speak with you. Thank you very much.
Great to be with you today. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, The Great War of Our Time. Michael Morrell is the author. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.